interesting topics for the next, you know, 5, 10 years of research. So I'll talk a little bit about gravitational wave astronomy, a little bit about high dimensional black holes, give a few examples of where numerical relativity has been useful and will probably be useful in the next few years. Then tomorrow and Wednesday, I'm going to talk a bit about the generalized harmonic formulation of general relativity. So I think Luis has sort of introduced that, he's mentioned it to you. He's probably described the ADM decomposition of the field equations and, you know, told you that it's only weakly hyperbolic. So in most situations, that's problematic. There are a couple of formulations which are known that seem to work well in general situations, the generalized harmonic and the BSSN, Baumgart, Shapiro, Shibata, Nakamura. I'm not going to be talking much about BSSN, but we'll go over the generalized harmonic formulation in quite a bit of detail. At least I'll sort of derive the form of the field equations in that form. Then on Thursday, when I won't be here on Thursday, but Luis is then going to talk about constraint damping in the generalized harmonic form. With a generalized harmonic formulation. So as I'm sure he's mentioned many times, you know, getting a well-posed mathematical formulation of the field equations is necessary, but it's not sufficient. And that's because the field equations have constraints. In any form that you can write them, essentially they're constraints. And so typically what happens if you have a solution that starts with initial data that has some part that doesn't satisfy the constraints, it grows exponentially. Now that is still mathematically well posed. Exponential growth is perfectly fine mathematically, and it has to be because, you know, many physical systems, you know, that's a very natural thing, exponential growth of solutions. It's just in these situations when that isn't part of the physics, we don't want these modes to be excited. And when you're doing numerical solutions, there's absolutely no way we can, at least in 3+1 type evolution schemes, where we can't, they will always be sourced at the level of a truncation error, no matter what numerical scheme you're using. Let me see if this is coming on yet. Okay, it's probably going to take a bit more time. Okay, so I think, like, so tomorrow I'll go over the generalized harmonic form. Then on Thursday, Luis is going to talk about constraint damping in the generalized harmonic form. But one thing I also want to talk about, which this is more general than numerical relativity, but I'd like to go over gravitational waves. And what's nice about sort of writing the field equations in the harmonic form, it's very straightforward to go to the linearized field equations and then derive the nature of gravitational waves in the weak field regime. So I'll do that on Wednesday. So this is sort of what I've been saying, sort of the outline. Let me get some of the lights off. Let's move in. Lights low. Okay. I think, but I don't know if you've, in your GR course, if you've sort of covered, you know, gravitational waves, you probably know some of the basics, but at least when we have the harmonic form, it's very straightforward to linearize the equations. And then it's not quite, it seems like it would be very straightforward to get the form of the linear, the standard plus cross polarization is all about gravitational waves. that's 2 days. But there's some tricky issues associated with gauge. And it's really straightforward to derive then the usual plus and cross polarized solutions to the linearized field equations. And then I'd also like to very briefly go over the quadrupole formula so you can get the other side of gravitational waves, which is sources of gravitational waves, how they're produced. I think that's an interesting thing to know about the field equations. Of course, that's sort of nothing a priori to do with numerical relativity, except, of course, now, as hopefully Luis has said this several times, and as you're starting to, you know, get some experience using numerical methods, one of the main questions is when you, you know, got a code that can stably solve a set of equations, will you get numbers out of it at the end of the day? Like, how do you interpret those numbers? What does it mean? So we're going to solve for the metric. Well, what does that mean? So you've got a stable solution, you've got the metric. Okay, you can compute distances. But that's sort of only the beginning. If you want to understand your solution, you have to apply all of the knowledge about the field equations that you've learned from the analytical studies. If you want to extract gravitational waves, we have to understand what a gravitational wave is. So it's important to have a solid mathematical background and an understanding of the physics to really first solve the field equations and then make sense of any of the solutions that you get. So I'll do that on Wednesday. What I'm going to try to do, the way that I'm going to introduce, we'll go over some of these topics. I'm going to just show you a little bit about gravitational wave astrophysics, instability of five-dimensional black strings, and an example of a higher dimensional problem, and then sort of critical collapse, which is an older topic, but this is numerics were essential in discovering this phenomena. So Matt Choptuik did this about 20 years ago. So this is a very nice example of some using numerics to get new answers. So the way that I'll sort of describe them, I'll give you a bit of an overview of these topics, give you some examples, but also just try to give you some idea of the computational issues and problems involved to motivate. Then what on the last day will be, I'll give an overview of adaptive mesh refinement. Say a very little bit about parallel computation, but it's mostly adaptive mesh refinement. So I'll talk about the Berger and Oliger algorithm. I'm not sure if any of you will sort of get to this in the labs. If you choose to do, say, the Tucholsky equation project, there's sort of towards the end, you could, if you wanted to, try to parallelize it with one of these libraries that we've, with a pre-existing library. That's probably a little bit beyond the scope of a, you know, a three-week crash course in numerical relativity. But I think this is essential in any interesting application. There are several examples of things that you can uncover in simple symmetry reduced situations where you don't need mesh refinement. But I think all of the interesting things going, you know, towards the future will require something like that. Most packages today offer some kind of adaptive mesh refinement, but it's useful to know just the basic ideas about it. So I'll try and give you an introduction to that on Friday. Of course, you know, if at any time, just interrupt, ask questions, etc. Okay, so let me just give you a couple of slides on gravitational wave astrophysics. And if any of you were at the meeting in Hamilton on Friday, this is just a couple of slides from there. So I'm just repeating some of that stuff. And this is probably not new to any of you. But what this slide is showing is that there's a very, there's been a strong effort over the last 20 odd years, even more, by the scientific community to try to observe the universe in gravitational waves. So we think that there are sources of gravitational waves. They're sort of, you know, the Hulse-Taylor binary pulsar is pretty, that was given the Nobel Prize in some sense because of to show that, you know, that's consistent with gravitational waves, the decay of the orbit. But there's not yet been any direct detection of gravitational waves. So, you know, there's several, you know, fronts where people are building detectors, the ground-based interferometers, resonant bar detectors, their plans for space-based detectors, or for observing various aspects, a couple of things in the universe that would be sensitive to gravitational waves. So timing residuals from pulsars, if you can time them accurately enough, you can infer the presence of a gravitational wave through the residuals in the pulsars. Or if there is some primordial production of gravitational waves, that will induce polarization in the cosmic microwave background. And if that can be observed, you can infer the presence of gravitational waves. So there's a strong effort to, you know, try to see the universe in gravitational waves. And this is sort of an expectation of what we might hope to find. Again, nothing has yet been observed. But I'd say it's not unreasonable to expect that perhaps the first detection will be within 5 years. Either cosmic microwave, pulsar, or LIGO. So to the space-based detectors, that's a few decades away, especially with the funding problems in NASA. Resonant bar detectors, I don't think the technology at present or, you know, in the near future is so these have been going for a long time. They just don't have the sensitivity to detect expected sources, and they haven't yet done. So resonant bar detectors is perhaps a technology that's not really going to be pursued. But these two observations and the ground-based interferometers will probably, one of them will get to the point where they can detect gravitational waves in a few years. So here what I'm listing on this chart is a bunch of expected sources. And so here the vertical axis is the strength of the source, how strong we think they should be in gravitational waves. When we get to the quadrupole formula, you sort of see where this sort of comes from. And basically the idea is it's motion of matter, something that has a time-varying quadrupole moment that can produce gravitational waves to leading order in GR. And the more compact the object is, and the faster that it's moving, the stronger the gravitational wave emission. So the most compact you can make an object in general relativity is a black hole. If you try to make anything that's more compact, it will just collapse to form a black hole in any case. So this is a limit in how compact you can make it. And in black hole mergers, close to the point where the two black holes collide, they're moving at perhaps 20-30% the speed of light. So this is sort of an ideal condition, you know, binary black hole system for producing strong gravitational waves. Other sources, other compact objects, like neutron star black holes, binary neutron star systems, pulsars, supernova, just binaries, neutron star binaries, for instance, the Hulse-Taylor binary, that is emitting gravitational waves. Extreme mass ratio in spirals, you know, and perhaps various exotic physics in the early universe. If any of these things existed or occurred, they might have produced gravitational waves and we might be able to observe them. And the other thing just to note about this plot is, just like the electromagnetic spectrum, the different frequencies are probing different fundamental astrophysical processes. So except for the first detection, which will be, I guess, will be a pretty big deal, that, you know, these experiments aren't really competing against each other. Once that first detection's out of the way, then it's really, you know, what can we learn about the universe by looking at gravitational waves in various frequency bands. Now, I'm not going to say anything about detection. I mean, I'm not enough of an expert on that, but just the sort of motivating why numerical relativity ties to this. So we're going to be looking at these compact object mergers. So for compact objects, it's a strong field solution. When they merge, it's very dynamical. It's in the nonlinear regime of the theory. We have to use numerical techniques to find solutions. And the reason why we need solutions for gravitational wave astrophysics is that despite how energetic some of these events are, you know, a sizable fraction of the rest mass is converted to energy, to gravitational wave energy, in a fraction of a second. So extremely efficient, strong sources of energy. The corresponding distortion in space-time is very weak. So by the time these ripples in space-time reach Earth, the sensitivities of, say, the LIGO detectors, they're essentially buried in the noise. You're not going to see any of these events directly above the noise of the instruments. But it's there, and for many of these sources, because they're sort of periodic in nature, they are data analysis techniques, in particular matched filtering, where if you know what you expect to see, if you have sort of a template bank of sources, you can convolve that with the signal and sort of extract something out of what appears to just be a noisy data stream. So if we understand these sources, then we can, we can enhance the signal-to-noise ratio capabilities of these instruments by a few orders of magnitude and make gravitational wave astrophysics viable with the present instruments. I think with the initial design of LISA, people now are trying to redesign it because of the funding situations. But the initial design of LISA, there would have been a few. I mean, if a supermassive black hole merger had occurred within a few, well, probably anywhere in the universe, it actually would have been strong enough to see above the LISA noise curve. But with LIGO, that's not the case. So we really need to understand the solutions to be able to actually observe them. Okay, so for this one example, I'm just going to briefly mention these binary compact objects. So a compact object, black hole or a neutron star. As I mentioned, they expect to be the strongest sources of gravitational waves in the universe. An interesting thing about general relativity and black holes is, in some sense, it's a very clean system. I mean, it's just described by the vacuum field equations. And if you think about it, it's a pretty remarkable situation in fundamental physics that we have a theory where we think, at least for a black hole that's in isolation, an exact solution to this theory describes the macroscopic object. So in other words, the black hole is really a spherical cow. We're not doing any approximations. We're giving a, solution to a fundamental theory that modulo other material that could be around, and that could be, you know, in some situations where there are accretion disks, it could be dynamically significant, but in most situations it's not going to be. And so we really are, you know, solving the exact equations up to Planck scale corrections for these systems. And that's not the case if we start, if we include neutron stars. Of course, because neutron stars, you know, we have to solve the hydrodynamic equations, etc., that govern neutron star physics. But those equations aren't the fundamental equations of nature, at least not what we think. I mean, those are QED, QCD, etc. But it's impossible to solve the fundamental equations for the structure of a neutron star. So when we include matter into the problem, there's a modeling step that has to go into there before we can actually even solve the equations. So of course, even the modeling the fundamental physics through, you know, hydrodynamics, or, you know, approximating the interactions through equations of state, assuming that there's some kind of thermodynamic equilibrium, you know, trying to deal with neutrinos as, you know, via Boltzmann equation, etc. So there's a first step where you approximate the fundamental physics with some continuum equations, and then you numerically solve them. I mean, at the end of the day, it's not going to make much of a difference, because, you know, we suspect we'll be able to model the fundamental physics to a degree where it doesn't really matter. But it's just an interesting side point that in GR, we're really not doing that modeling step. We actually are solving the fundamental equations. Okay, even though, you know, in GR we're not simplifying things, it's still not an easy problem. From a mathematical point of view, from a mathematical numerical point of view, there are several issues that make it complicated. One, for compact object mergers, there's no symmetry in the problem. You really need a full 3+1 code. So one thing with 3+1 evolution, and this is what I mentioned for the ADM form, the sort of what would be perhaps the intuitive way of trying to solve the field equations, is only weakly hyperbolic and it doesn't work. In some symmetry reduced situations, the ADM form, you can actually make it to work. You can actually, you know, with a appropriate set of gauge conditions, and the symmetry sort of kills some of these problematic modes. But basically, you really need to rewrite the field equations in a way where it's strongly hyperbolic, at least. Of course, as I mentioned, that's just the first step. That's not the sufficient, that's a necessary but not sufficient condition. Even if you do come up with a formulation that's well posed, you need to deal with the constraints. The fact that in a typical 3+1 scheme, or in any 3+1 scheme, in a free evolution, there are going to be constraint equations that you can only satisfy to within truncation error. And unlike the Maxwell equations, which has a similar problem, they're linear. And so there are ways which you can enforce the constraints in Maxwell's equations, constraint transport, for instance, where you can enforce them at the discrete level as well, those constraints. You can come up with methods that enforce the constraints at the discrete level. Because the Einstein equations are nonlinear, there's really no way to do that. You have to have a formulation that's sort of robust to possible constraint violations. So the generalized harmonic form with constraint damping is one of these. So the generalized harmonic gets you a strongly even a symmetric hyperbolic form of the field equations, but it does have, if you just naively discretize it, you do have problems with the constraints. And so then there's this constraint damping technique. I think Luis probably spoke about constraint damping in the ENM system, and it's a similar idea for generalized harmonic evolution. And then there are a whole bunch of issues about choosing good coordinate systems, proper boundary conditions, excision, etc., that you need to deal with. The other thing that's challenging is just the computational scope of the problem. So even if you think of the cleanest system, so let's just look at a vacuum binary black hole merger, there's several orders of magnitude of spatial and temporal length scales that need to be resolved. So for example, with a binary black hole merger, you have to resolve the black holes at the smallest scale. So the radius is about, you know, the length scale is about the Schwarzschild radius of the black hole, so 2m. Of course, then there's an intermediate scale, that's the orbital dynamics, and that's important because that's going to be the source of the gravitational waves. But you can measure the gravitational waves in the strong field regime. There's no unambiguous way of identifying a gravitational wave. So to actually measure the gravitational waves that LIGO might see, you have to go out into the wave zone, which is an order of magnitude further away. So where the metric is actually just a little perturbation above Minkowski space. So even in this case, you need, you know, two orders of magnitude of spatial scales that you have to be able to resolve. In the field equations, your characteristic speed is the speed of light. So the temporal scales and spatial scales are directly related. And essentially what that implies is you can just naively take a unigrid evolution scheme and say, well, I'll just throw it on a supercomputer. Even that's not sufficient. You have to be more efficient with the way in which you discretize the equations. And so AMR, at least for finite difference methods, is one way of trying to be, in some sense, using the resources that you have in an optimal way. Now, of course, if you include matter, you know, things get much more complicated very, very quickly. And if you actually think of, you know, perhaps say an ultimate question, you might want to say, well, what is a progenitor of a short gamma ray burst? So people think perhaps binary neutron stars might be. So that will be an in-spiral of two neutron stars. But then they're going to, when they merge, they're going to form a black hole in some manner. But there's going to be matter left out on an accretion disk. That presumably is going to create some jet structure. It's going to launch a jet. And eventually that jet is going to, by some process, create a gamma ray burst. Or at least that's the hypothesis. But just that whole process, so you know, the GR part of it, where the strong field dynamics is important, that happens in a few milliseconds. The short gamma ray burst happens on timescales of seconds. So there you have now several orders of magnitude of additional timescales that you have to resolve. And all of these other physics actually introduce even scales that are even shorter than the compact object scale. So if there's an accretion disk and the magnetorotational instability is important, then you have to resolve that. So I think the vacuum problem by itself is, you know, at today's level of supercomputing, the terascale project, this kind of, you know, imagining doing the complete, in some of these systems where matter is important, doing the complete problem is something that's, you know, for the next generation, for you guys. It's something like 5 to 10 years from now, computers might be powerful enough to actually do all of these things. So let me just show you an example of a binary black hole merger. So this was one that was done with the harmonic scheme. Excision to deal with the singularities. So I don't know if Luis mentioned anything about that, but so, you know, inside black holes, there are geometric singularities. We can evolve singularities. There's a couple of ways in which you can deal with it. And one is just to take advantage of the causal structure of the space-time. So once you're inside the horizon, all characteristics, any information propagates towards the center. So if you sort of put a boundary of your computational domain, and you just don't put any boundary conditions there because all the characteristics are flowing outwards, then you sort of cut out the singularity, and that's what's referred to as excision. This is somewhat of an old code, so second order finite difference, but it's adequate. It's not that accurate, but it gives you the answer. It's Bergen-Olger style mesh refinement. So I'll show you an example of the mesh hierarchy, and then on Friday we'll sort of go over this algorithm for evolving finite difference equations on such a kind of hierarchy. It uses Kreis-Holliger dissipation. Well, all these examples use Kreis-Holliger dissipation. I think Luis has described that before, right? So as I mentioned, one of the issues is always boundary conditions. And in this case, the boundary conditions are spatially compactified such that the edge of the domain is actually at spatial infinity. And that's not so that we can extract radiation there. It's just so we can place the correct Minkowski space-time boundary conditions at that point. And this uses Cook-Pfeiffer quasi-circular initial data. So as we'll see, like, tomorrow, the generalized harmonic form doesn't actually make use of lapse and shift and all those variables. You actually evolve the metric. But once you get the solution, you can transform it to whatever form you want. It's actually useful to look at the lapse. So this is the lapse function. So this is a binary black hole system on a quasi-circular orbit. The little black dots is the excision surface, which is actually slightly inside the horizon. So the horizon's about 30% bigger than the black circle. This thing, it's emitting gravitational waves right now, so it's spiraling in. They eventually merge, they form a Kerr black hole, and it rings down. So this simulation, that's just a few seconds here, took about 100,000 CPU hours in total. So that was about 5 years ago. But I think the interesting thing about the way that Moore's Law, when Moore's Law continues to be, computers continue to be getting twice as fast roughly every 2 years. But it's sort of, since the 2000s, the twice as fast has sort of been effective in terms of how, for a given amount of dollars, how much processing power can you get? Because the clock speeds are pretty much topped out at 3 gigahertz or something like that. So today, this would still take about 100,000 CPU hours. But now each core, each CPU hour is much, much cheaper through multi-core systems. So effectively, it would take less to get such a thing. But just to give you an idea of the kind of scale that we're looking at, these are hundreds of thousands of hours. So of course, you have to parallelize. You don't want to wait 100,000 hours. You might 1,000 hours, a couple of months, you might be able to want to wait. So you need to run it on hundreds to thousands of CPUs. So parallelization is essential for these problems. Let me just show you the gravitational waves from the simulation. So the first thing that you'll see, so this is just zooming out a little bit. So the two little black holes are there. So the first thing that you noticed, there was a burst of radiation, and that was an artifact of the initial data. So that in and of itself is a big problem in numerical relativity. How do you specify physically relevant initial data? After that passes, sort of these quadrupolar arms, that's the emission that's being produced by the in spiral. Then they finally merge, and you get the ring down signal. And this is a logarithmic color scale, so you could see sort of the early emission and the late time emission. This sort of chunky stuff, that's truncation error. So that's really not the part of the signal. Perhaps I can just play it again. So initial data, right? So physically, astrophysically relevant initial data, this binary black hole presumably has been spiraling in for a long time. So there should be this train of waves going out at t equals zero. That's not part of this initial data. It's assuming that it's conformally flat. So that's where you get this transient. That's a problem that's not really been solved yet, but at least it leaves a computational domain on roughly a light crossing time. So if we throw away the first light crossing time of the simulation, that's fine. So this structure over there, that's what I mentioned before, that you can't unambiguously define what a gravitational wave is in the strong field zone. So this is using one of these Newman-Penrose scalars, which is just a second time derivative of this, the usual polarization. So we'll derive the nature of gravitational waves, this plus cross polarization. But in the strong field regime, you see, it didn't look like a wave. It seemed like the structure that was rotating around. And that's just, it's a strong field. This curvature scalar is registering curvature, but it's not noticing the gravitational waves. You really have to go some distance before it actually is a measure of gravitational waves. Here's an example of the mesh structure. So again, with this Bergen-Ollinger style adaptive mesh refinement, as we'll go over on Friday, you cover your computational domain with a sequence of uniform meshes. And so this sort of shows you the structure of the meshes. This is spatial infinity. I think here I've coarsened it by a ratio of 4 to 1. So it's actually 4 times finer, but just so you can see the structure of the meshes. And so I'm just gonna zoom in on the, so this is the very far field where we put the correct boundary conditions. So now sort of zooming in, this might sort of be the wave zone where we can sort of extract the waves. And then this is the orbital zone, and then we have to resolve each of the black holes. So you can see it's trying to be more efficient with the use of resources than just the naive uniform discretization. And as I'll sort of briefly go over on Friday, resources scale like essentially some number to the power of the dimension. So if you need n points to resolve the system, and this is a 3+1 dimensional simulation, you need n to the fourth flops essentially. It scales like n to the fourth power. which is a very, very large number. So if you need high resolution or high accuracy, you need a large N. And so if you had a uniform discretization, it would essentially be impossible to do a problem like this. So you really need to do mesh refinement. Okay, so let me give you another example in higher dimensional gravity. So astrophysics, that's probably one of the primary sources of funding for people that are interested in gravity. That's one of the main reasons why this is a problem that you might be able to get a job in if you went into academia and gravity. But there's also a lot of interesting work where relativity might play a role in higher dimensional gravity. And one motivation for studying higher dimensional gravity is string theory. So string theory, you know, it's a candidate theory for the theory of quantum gravity. It's arguably perhaps the best one we have, but I mean, we don't know. There's really no experimental or observational constraints of the Planck regime. But the one thing that's emerged in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, it's actually been over 10 years now, that's come out of string theory is this ADS-CFT correspondence, this gauge gravity duality. And this could potentially be very interesting. Well, it is interesting, even if string theory isn't the correct theory of quantum gravity. I mean, it might even be, you know, that the theory that resolves the conflicts between general relativity and quantum mechanics on the Planck scale isn't even a quantum theory like the one we're used to. There might be a completely different theory. We don't know. But that doesn't matter. From the point of view of this ADS-CFT, if we sort of think of this as a tool that allows us to understand strongly coupled gauge theories in terms of gravitational physics. And so that's sort of an interesting motivation for studying higher dimensional gravity, you know, whether or not string theory is right. And essentially, you know, the idea is if we have an asymptotically anti-de Sitter space, ADS, anti-de Sitter space time, or the duality says that string theory in anti-de Sitter space is dual to a conformal field theory living on the boundary. So as well as you can model ordinary physics by a conformal field theory, you can map those problems to a gravitational problem. And it's in the limit where it's a strongly coupled conformal field theory that maps to pure Einstein gravity in anti-de Sitter space. So strongly coupled conformal field theories are very difficult to solve. And not that Einstein gravity is that much easier, but at least there is a way which we can solve it, numerical relativity or, you know, exact solutions. And so there's been a lot of suggestions to understand or to try to understand some complicated problems in regular four-dimensional physics using gravity in five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space-time. And the interesting thing is that in most of these dual applications, black holes are sort of key players in the gravity side of the correspondence. And the thing that's interesting in higher dimensions is you've got a whole new class of solutions with some different properties from the usual four-dimensional ones. So as with, you know, with 4D black holes, you know, most of what's been known about these higher dimensional black holes has come from analytic studies or perturbative calculations. And they're just like the ordinary black holes that, for the most part, and they have the usual kinds of properties. So they have event horizons. You can characterize them using global methods or local properties, trapped surfaces, essentially, apparent horizons or isolated horizons. They have singularities. The usual quasi-stationary laws of black hole mechanics describes small changes of the horizon. They related to gravitational collapse, they Hawking radiate, etc. But some things are, a couple of properties of these high-dimensional black holes are very different from the four-dimensional ones. One is that there's no strict uniqueness of stationary solutions. So, you know, with four-dimensional black holes, you know, the no-hair theorems, if you're in vacuum, says that the Kerr family of black holes is a unique solution, stationary solution to the field equations that contain event horizons. In higher dimensions, that's not the case in the sense that if you look at asymptotic, you know, charges, so mass and angular momentum, there'll be several different kinds of horizon structures that are consistent with the same asymptotics. So for example, you could have a rotating higher dimensional spherical-like black hole, or you can have a black hole, a rotating ring, so a toroidal topology. And those will have the same mass and angular momentum. So they'll look the same at infinity, but you've got different black hole topologies. But perhaps more interesting is that many of these higher dimensional black objects, rings, holes, spheres, etc., are actually unstable, as opposed to the four-dimensional ones, which seem to be stable. So to understand, most of these properties have come as in the 60s and 70s when people uncovered the properties of four-dimensional black holes, have come through studying exact solutions or perturbations of exact solutions. But if we really want to understand that the dynamical non-linear regime of the theory, again, we need to go to numerical solutions. So let me just give you this one example of a five-dimensional black string. So this is the metric of a five-dimensional black string. So it's very simple. This is just, if you just look at this part, this is just four-dimensional Schwarzschild, and we're just adding a single fifth Euclidean dimension. So this satisfies the five-dimensional vacuum Einstein equation. So this is not within necessarily within the ADS-C of T correspondence. We're not in anti de Sitter space, but this is just an example of a higher dimensional black hole. And similar kind of black holes exist in ADS space, but this is just a simpler asymptotically flat case. So again, your usual solution, here M is now just mass per unit length as opposed to the total mass of the spacetime. So kind of quite a simple solution, but in the early 90s, Gregory and Flam showed that it's actually unstable to perturbations in that extra dimension. So that W, that's the coordinate in the extra dimension. So let's look for harmonic perturbations. If you look at perturbations in all the other coordinates, the radial coordinate, the angular coordinates, they decay exponentially with these damped sinusoids, the quasi-normal modes. But what they found is that for short wave numbers, mu, or equivalently long wavelengths, that they are positive exponential growing modes. So for example, this is the five-dimensional case. So yeah, they have 4+1. And if you convert it to a wavelength, they find for perturbations above a critical wavelength of 14, roughly 14 times the mass per unit length. That's what meters, that's mass per unit length. So for long wavelength perturbations, there's an unstable mode in this extra direction. Now there'd been a lot of debate and controversy about what the end state of this instability was going to be. And they'd argued, Gregory and Flam originally argued, that it's going to bifurcate. So you've got this string-like direction, you're putting little perturbations on it, the ripples grow, and based on an entropic argument, they argued that it should eventually grow and pinch off into spherical black holes. And the entropic argument is essentially that above a certain length scale, so something that's very close to the dynamical, the 14 that they derive from perturbation analysis, you find that the area of a sequence of black spheres is larger than the area of a black string. So if you equate area with entropy, then the sequence of black strings is higher entropy. So they argue that that's the end state. But what would be interesting or surprising about that is, this is just classical GR. And in classical GR, black holes can't bifurcate. They can't change topology without there being a naked singularity. So if this happened, this would be a violation of cosmic censorship. So what added to the confusion is Horowitz and Maeda sort of proved a little while later that these black strings actually can't, the horizons can't pinch to zero in finite affine time of the generators. So then the photons, the null curves that form the generators of the horizon, you count time on them with the affine parameters. So it's sort of a formal notion of time, and they prove that time cannot be finite if they go to zero. But of course, sort of any theorem is only as good as its assumptions, and it turned out that this finite affine time assumption was a problem. So they do seem to pinch off, as I'll show you in animation the next one. But the other sort of bit of interesting thing about this system is, over the last few years, well, it started back in the 70s and 80s with the membrane paradigm, but it's really become very sort of much more concrete in the last few years. There's been suggestions that horizon dynamics is very much like hydrodynamics, so that in the long wavelength limit, perturbations of higher dimensional black hole horizons satisfy Navier-Stokes type equations. And if that's the case, so what Cardoso and Diaz pointed out is, well, this is showing a thin stream of fluid that's subject to this Rayleigh plateau instability. So if you go to a faucet, you turn on a tap, and try to make as thin a stream of water as you can, you'll find out that it will always bead up. And that's not an initial condition at the faucet. That's because this is unstable. It's unstable to forming these beads. And the argument here is not an entropy argument, but an energy argument. But at least if there is this connection between black hole, the dynamics of an event horizon and a fluid, then it's sort of then you would think that the horizon would do the same thing. So with Luis, we simulated this example to try to figure out what actually happens beyond the linear regime. So again, this is a code that used harmonic evolution, excision and constraint damping. In this case, it's a five-dimensional simulation. So four-dimensional, so 3+1-dimensional simulations, I think they're doable on contemporary computer systems, at least if you don't throw in too many, you don't need too many orders of magnitude of spatial and length scales to resolve. 5+1-dimensional, that's again for next generation of computers. So we had to reduce the symmetry of the problem. So this is effectively a 2+1-dimensional evolution. So we assume spherical symmetry orthogonal to the fifth dimension and time. Fourth order code, run cutter integration. Now the sixth order style, Kreis-Holliger dissipation, but the same basic idea. Also Berger and Holliger mesh refinement, initial data. And as opposed to the black hole evolution that I showed you before, here we didn't compactify to spatial infinity, but we also put Dirichlet boundary conditions. And that's not correct at that finite distance, but this is a sort of a pretty common thing in numerical relativity as well. It's challenging to come up with constraint or boundary conditions that are consistent with a constraint. But one thing you can do, if your simulation isn't going to last the light crossing time, well, you just make the boundaries big enough that the boundaries essentially is not in causal contact with the interior part of the domain. So we put the boundaries sufficiently far away that any error that we introduced by putting exact Dirichlet conditions is not going to come in and artificially influence the results for the string. So this is an embedding diagram of the horizon of the black string. And so you'll see as how this evolves is it really is evolving very much like a stream of fluid. So it is becoming very thin, it's starting to pinch off. But the interesting thing here is you see it's evolving in a self-similar manner. So at each stage of this, through the development of this instability, it looks like locally a thin string, but that is unstable to the same kind of mechanism as the original string, and this proceeds sort of in a self-similar fashion down to arbitrary small scales, at least as small scales as we were able to get with finite resources. Let me just show you the same simulation, but now just zooming in a little bit, and also in real time. So the spatial scales are linked to the temporal scales. So when the late time, the smaller little spherical beads form, they also form on a quicker time scale. In the previous one, the time was slowing down so that you could see that. Now this was a 2+1-dimensional simulation, but this one also took about 100,000 CPU hours. And the reason is because these very small scales are forming, we have to resolve them. And so this actually, so the previous example with the binary black hole, there were 8 levels of mesh refinement. This one actually had 17 levels of mesh refinement to get down to this level. So by this time, we have extremely fine resolution that's necessary to resolve these very small scales. But we just couldn't go beyond this. So we're surmising that this cascade will continue to arbitrary small scales. It will terminate in a finite time, but you'll have arbitrary small black holes. But again, we can only get it to this point and then extrapolate the trends. But this is also to show you the utility of something like mesh refinement. And in particular, the Berger and Holliger style algorithm that we'll go over on Friday is with some of these solutions, especially when you're going into regimes where you don't know what the answer is, you don't know where the small length scales are going to prop up. You want an algorithm where it will adapt to the solution in a way that's automatic, and that's the Berger and Holliger algorithm sort of provides this mechanism. So let's say,
when those black holes are very small and tiny, don't they evaporate?
So if you did include quantum effects that yeah, at some point they would evaporate. So this is a purely classical calculation. So in this case, there's no evaporation, but there are some things that will happen. So let's introduce a Planck scale at some point. So let's say black holes below a certain scale are now going to evaporate relatively quickly. And there are going to be a couple of competing effects. One is, as you'll notice, they're actually also going to start moving. They're gravitationally going to attract each other. So let me see if I can point that out. So there's at one point, this was the one that was happening too quickly. But if you notice carefully, there was a little black hole that had been created there, and it actually merged with this one. So when all the strings are severed, well, that's going to be a quantum process as well. Imagine that they are severed and it's not in a relatively mild way. Most of these black holes are going to merge. The very small ones will Hawking evaporate. But the larger ones will merge in a time scale that's much faster than the Hawking evaporation scale. Okay, so we're running out of time. Let me just very quickly go over critical phenomena. This is also another nice example of the use of adaptive mesh refinement, and you know that scale that sort of interesting problems, you can't necessarily anticipate what's going to happen. And so this was discovered by Matt Choptwick about 20 years ago, and this was sort of behavior that arises when you look at the threshold of black hole formation. So the canonical example here is you take some matter energy, in this case he used the scalar field, so just a massless scalar field. And he said, well, if you take a blob of matter that's sufficiently massive, it's going to collapse to form a black hole. If it's a very weak perturbation, it's just going to behave like radiation, it's going to disperse. And what happens at the threshold of black hole formation? So now you adjust the amplitude that's just on the verge of forming a black hole. And he found that you get sort of behavior that's very much like a phase transition in a statistical mechanical system. In particular, the solution becomes universal near threshold. It's scale invariant in an interesting way. And the power law scaling of order parameters, in this case, the mass of the black hole near threshold. Let me just show you the example. So this is an axisymmetric simulation. This is the axis of symmetry. This is the amplitude of the scalar field, and I'm just going to show you the three examples. So this is a case where it's very weak perturbation. So what you can see is that this just propagates outwards, essentially on a spherical cone. So it's just like a wave in flat space. If you have a very strong perturbation, you can see that it's very different behavior. And what's forming is a black hole is forming. At some point, actually, here a black hole is formed. There's no excision in this code. This is something called maximal slicing. So in some sense, time slows down as you approach the singularity of the black hole. So there is a horizon there, and the scalar field is becoming singular. And now when you tune to the threshold of this, what happens is the space-time starts to undergo a self-similar collapse. In fact, it's something that's discretely self-similar. So it starts to echo. But each one of these little echoes happens on a time scale that's 30 times faster than the previous echo, and on a spatial scale, that's 30 times faster. So in fact, in the last frame of this animation, there were two more little oscillations of the field. And in theory, if you could tune this to arbitrary precision, that would happen indefinitely. So just to show you that that's actually what's happening, I've transformed to logarithmic coordinates. And so you can see what this echoing solution is. And so this is in the last frame of the last thing, this is where these last two echoes happened. And so you can see that the time is really slowing down. And so at threshold, if you could really tune to the threshold of black hole formation, you'll have an infinite train of these echoes going down to arbitrary small scales. So as you can imagine, to actually resolve those length scales, you needed. Well, it was crucial that Matt used adaptive mesh refinement. Okay, so this just shows you what a discretely self-similar solution is. So I'm going to skip over that. I'll finish in a couple of minutes. But here's an example of a code now which actually uses, or at least it's motivated by the ADM formalism. And it works and it's stable, but this is because it's in axisymmetry. And in particular, because the equations were manipulated in a way where the gauge condition was explicitly enforced, and it was a constrained evolution. So it's a very different system from the general 3 plus 1 ADM form. But it's also to demonstrate that, I mean, there are other ways of going about solving the field equations. There's no unique way of coming up with a set of evolution equations, and this was actually a constrained evolution. So we don't solve all the evolution equations, we just solve a subset of them, and then the constrained equations with the elliptic condition. And this is actually one where, okay, it takes perhaps a few days, but you can do it on a single CPU. Let me just show you one example. So one of the interesting things about the critical solution is it's conjectured to be universal. In other words, it doesn't matter what initial data you start with. If you tune to the threshold, all structure of the initial data gets radiated away, and you're left with a self-similar echoing core. So this was one example where we were trying to test this conjecture, and we were actually trying to break it. It's a roughly spherical distribution of energy, but in the scalar field, we make the profile, we made it anti-symmetric in this coordinate Z. So this is sort of the center of collapse. And so if we start with large initial data, we form a big black hole around rho and Z equals zero. But because of this anti-symmetry is a property which is preserved, it's a symmetry of the solution. So it has to be preserved in time, and in particular, that origin point has to stay zero for all time. So this echoing solution can't possibly develop there. So we thought, okay, this has to be a different solution. But this is what happens. So it starts. So yeah, the symmetry is preserved, but instead of having a single echoing solution at threshold, you get these two little echoing solutions that develop on either side of it. And locally, as you start going to threshold, it starts to approach the spherical critical solution. So just to show you, okay, the transforming to one of them, you can see this is what we had before. I'll just end by showing you the mesh structure. And in this case, we needed 25 levels of 2-to-1 refinement to resolve that final critical solution. So let me just zoom in onto it. As you can see, eventually, sort of magnification factor of 500,000. But the other thing that I want to just point out with this kind of structure is, again, there's no way we could have anticipated where these two little peaks would form. I mean, we didn't expect this to happen. But this adaptive mesh refinement algorithm, you don't have to be clever. It will figure out for you where you need the resolution. And so that's also a nice example of this Berglund-Olliger stuff. So we'll cover Berglund-Olliger refinement on Friday. Tomorrow we'll go do the harmonic formalism. Wednesday, gravitational waves. Thursday, constrained damping. And then Friday, this stuff. Any questions? Okay, thanks.